KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, he revolutionized the treatment of alcoholism and helped save millions of lives in the process. Before Bill Wilson died in 1971, he overcame great odds and obstacles to create Alcoholics Anonymous, which now has some 2 million members worldwide. We'll talk with the director of a new documentary titled Bill W. It examines Wilson's life and how he built AA into an international powerhouse for personal transformation while struggling to stand on the pedestal his supporters put him on. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. The Alcoholics Anonymous movement was founded in Akron, Ohio in 1935 by a Wall Street analyst named Bill Wilson, with help from Dr. Bob Smith. Wilson himself was an alcoholic. He died in 1991. And today, AA has some 2 million members, with more than 100,000 AA groups all over the world. A new documentary titled Bill W. traces Wilson's life and the growth of AA, and it's playing this week, opening this week in Bay Area theaters. This hour, we're talking with the film's co-producer and director, Dan Carasino. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Also here, Keith Humphreys. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford's School of Medicine and also a research scientist at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto. Good to have you here as well.
Glad to be here.
Well, let me just begin by asking you, Dan, sort of who was this guy? Where did he come from, and how did he get to the point where he founded this this organization?
Well, Scott, thank you very much, first of all, for having us on the air. And just one quick correction. Bill Wilson died in 1971, so he died almost 40 years ago.
What did I say?
I think you had said 1991.
Oh, I meant to say 71, sorry.
That's right. But where Bill was a Vermonter, interestingly enough, so was Dr. Bob. And he grew up in a marble town in East Dorset and also in Rutland, Vermont. And there was alcoholism in his family. But he didn't drink until he was in his early 20s when he got into the Army, which is a common story, I think. And for a lot of people, he had, you know, there are two types of alcoholics, apparently. One of the things that Kevin and I always point out when we're talking to people is that neither of us are alcoholics. Kevin Hanlon is the gentleman I made this with, a very good friend of mine. And but in doing the research on this, what we found is that there are people who when they first pick up alcohol, they react to it positively and they're off and running. And then there are other types of people who can drink for a while and then it develops for them later on. Bill Wilson was the first type. He picked up the drink and he was off and running. And
by off and running, you mean what?
But by that he couldn't control it. From the very beginning, he couldn't control it. He would drink to excess. He would fall. I don't know if he was a fall down drunk, but he just couldn't control his drinking.
Yeah.
And so, as it is with many alcoholics, they're able to
function
for a while, and then finally it overcomes them.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened with him. He had sort of the typical journey for an alcoholic, and I think that's why he later on is able to speak to so many alcoholics.
It seems like from the documentary that he used alcohol like a lot of people do, whether they're alcoholics or not, to sort of overcome sort of a social awkwardness.
Absolutely. He talks about his first drink and he's at this – he always felt like he came from the wrong side of the tracks. Okay, he always felt like he didn't belong. Even the woman he marries, he feels that she and her family are above him. And so he goes to this this party. It's put together by some wealthy socialites, I think, in the town that he's staying in the Army. And while he's there, he's off in the corner, and he can't relate to anybody. And somebody gives him a drink, and it's his first drink. And he says, and suddenly the whole world changed. I'm able to talk to people. I'm able to converse. I'm able to relate with people in a way I never could. And again, that's apparently a very common thing for people who have alcoholism.
And he describes it as an obsession. He uses that word over and over again.
Yeah, he says that he makes a distinction. He says it's not the habit of drinking; it's the obsession of drinking. And in talking to people in the making of the film, they seize on that. They say that's exactly what happens to them. These thoughts just, you know, just they can't get them out of their heads.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Keith Humphreys, talk about how you think AA changed the way the medical establishment thinks about addiction and alcoholism in particular.
Sure. I mean, at the time in the 1930s, medicine was completely hopeless about alcoholics. Doctors did all they could to keep alcoholics out of the hospital and keep them away from medicine because it was felt, you know, nothing could be done. They're a waste of time. They're difficult. We don't like them personally. We disapprove of them and so on. And so the miracle really of AA is you had two of these rejected, hopeless people who figured out they could help each other. And that is really the fount of hope for addiction treatment for the next 3 decades until you get a modern addiction treatment system that is more optimistic. But at the time, this is what there was. It was the only game in town, yeah. And it was born out of desperation.
Well, let's play actually a short clip from the film where a historian, Bill White, is talking about that very thing, what it was like for alcoholics in the early 20th century and how they were viewed and treated, such as it was, by the medical profession.
There was a sense, there was a kind of belief that there was no such thing as alcoholism as a primary disorder. There was only untreated underlying psychiatric illness. So what that meant was alcoholics were subjected to mandatory sterilization laws along with the mentally ill. It meant they were subjected to the heydays of electro and chemoconvulsive therapies. It means they were subjected to psychosurgery, particularly prefrontal lobotomies. On the theory that there was an alcoholic personality, and if they altered that personality by brain surgery, that it would cure their alcoholism.
Again, that clip is from the new documentary called Bill W., tracing the life of Bill Wilson, founder of AA. And Keith Humphreys, wow. That is really takes you back. And, of course, we've heard a lot about electroshock therapy and even lobotomies much, much more recently, like in the 60s, and it's even making a comeback now in some ways. But what was it about AA that really just changed the way the establishment looked at it? Was it that it seemed to work?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it was an area where there was so much disappointment and so much desperation that people were willing to try anything, as you just heard, as Bill White just said, including a lot of grossly inhumane and horrible things. But AA, you know, starting with two people in the mid-30s, by 1950 has something like 50,000 members. And so you had all of a sudden lots of people knew somebody who was in this strange new program who was getting better. And that led to media interest, and that led to more and more members.
And Dan Carosino, describe how he went about, I don't want to say proselytizing exactly, but building this organization. I mean, at one point, as you show in the documentary, he and his wife had sort of a dry house. There were people, you know, drunks, as he called them, living there, trying to keep them sober.
Well, the way he goes about this, when he has what's a, he has what he calls a white light experience, okay? He's a hopeless drunk. It looks like he's going to have to be committed, and suddenly he's released from this. And we can get into that a little bit if we have time. But what happens then after that happens is that for the first 6 months, he goes out and he thinks everybody has to have the experience that he's had. And he's completely unsuccessful. No, nobody gets sober. And he realizes then that, like, I think it's Lois who says to him, he says, you know, he's feeling a little despondent, and he says, you know, over the last six months, I haven't helped anybody get sober. And she says to him, yes, but you've stayed sober. And he has this understanding then that in talking to these other people, that's how he's staying sober. And he's no longer on a soapbox preaching to people. He then has a much more humble approach to it. And so when that happens, it takes a couple of years for them being Dr. Bob, the other co-founder of AA, to get about 40 people into the program. And In late 1937, they count heads and they realize, hey, we have something here. And they feel this sense of responsibility to get this out to people. And so their initial thought is that they'll work in hospitals, because of the first 40 people, I think they all came through a hospital.
Referred by doctors?
Well, mostly because of Dr. Bob, but also because of Bill's relationship with there was a place called Towns Hospital that worked with people. And so everybody, they thought that was the model. And so they thought they'd raise money. And it was basically because of failure that they were forced to write a book. That was like their third option. And they wrote the book that became Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took a while for that to get traction. But they slowly built it. It took a couple of years. And they were very fortunate in a way because they didn't get immediate traction. And what happened is that they had this explosive growth in Cleveland. Of the first 900 members, 800 are in Cleveland. And and because of that, they find ways that they can spread the message that they don't need to have as much control as they think. They don't need to have what they were calling paid missionaries. This theory of sponsorship develops where a new person goes out and speaks to a newer person. And so they then lay the groundwork. And in 1941, the Saturday Evening Post publishes an article. And it after that, everything changes. It just grows explosively.
And just go back a little bit, because some of this was happening during the temperance movement, during Prohibition. Not the founding, but, you know, certainly what Bill Wilson was going through, you know, was happening at a time when there was a lot of judgment, as we heard, about alcohol in general. How did the temperance movement play off of what he was trying to do there in the early to mid-30s?
Well, AA forms after Prohibition, almost immediately after Prohibition. I think Prohibition ends around 1931 or something.
Yeah, well, I think it was after Roosevelt came in.
And so, AA does form after Prohibition. And so he doesn't have to deal with that argument anymore. That they called it the wet-dry issue. And that was something that had broken up societies in the 19th century that had also equally discovered that two drunks talking to each other can stay sober. But they would always get into these arguments about how do you best do it. And AA wasn't immune from that. In the 1940s, there were people publishing papers under the banner of AA arguing for the same thing. But the issue had sort of been decided because of the failure of Prohibition.
Yeah.
And so then it was just a question of Bill Wilson preventing AA members from engaging AA in controversy, and he succeeded in that.
Yeah. There's a bit of controversy to this day about the role of religion and spirituality in 12-step programs generally, but there's some documents you have in the documentary showing how the 12 steps were kind of edited and changed. And talk about that process and how he, Bill Wilson, and Dr. Bob, how they came up with those 12 steps and how others gave input into what they would be.
Well, AA develops from a group called the Oxford Group, which was initially called First Century Christianity. We saw a letterhead of theirs that for their first, you know, decade or so, they were known as First Century Christianity. So they were an overtly Christian group. And they never really had steps. Bill Wilson retroactively sort of went back and said it was a six-step program then. But again, they never really had steps for people. And then Bill, when he's writing the book, he realizes that they've got to get they're at the meat of the thing. Okay, how does it work? And I think the chapter is called How It Works. And it's in that chapter that he writes the 12 steps. And he's the primary author of it. He would never take that authorship himself in terms of he would always give credit to the other members in helping him write it and to the Oxford Group. But that's how they came about in writing the 12 steps. And the notion of God and all of that, there were very conscious decisions made not to be an exclusively Christian movement. And I attribute most of that to Bill W., that he saw that there were people who were agnostic, people who were atheistic, and he just wanted to make the thing as wide as possible, the net as wide as possible for people.
Yeah. Well, I want to bring in now somebody who has been a part of AA as a member. Peter joins us now from Mill Valley. Peter, good to have you with us.
Hi there. Yeah, I'd just like to congratulate the filmmakers on what I consider to be an excellent bio-documentary. And I say that probably for three reasons. First, it didn't sanctify the life of Bill W. In other words, it showed warts and all imperfections as well as various progresses in living a better life. And then I think secondly, for people who are familiar with the readings of the Alcoholics Anonymous book or even have heard his voice on tape, it put a human face. And to see somebody actively growing a movement, which I think the Dalai Lama described as the greatest spiritual movement in the 20th century, I think was a great help to everybody.
Yeah. How did you get involved?
I've been a journalist in London in the 1980s, and I won't say I was a victim of the drinking culture, but I'll say I probably drank for England. And in that sense, you know, my life simply unfolded in ways I didn't want. And I think the film, you know, captured where drinking can take you. So although in my case I was still working, still had a place to live, if I speak about inner loneliness or spiritual deprivation, I think that's the best way to describe where I was at. So when you were speaking just a few minutes back about the distinction between religion and spirituality, I think that's a really important gift that AA brings to people. And I won't speak for everybody. I can only say it's helped my own spiritual well-being. There were a couple of things in the movie which maybe personally I would like to have seen, and some of them are what I call the slogans. Today they're commonplace, a day at a time, there but for the grace of God go I, think, think, think. And the one which always makes me smile most is easy does it, because if ever you go to a meeting and you look at the cars outside the meeting, the cars with the biggest dents on the bumper always have easy does it. And I think about that today, that there are guidelines for a better way to live a life, which is often done in simplicity, that I think that movie caught.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful that somebody from outside the fellowship was able to bring a sense of objectivity to me in documentary filmmaking. I review films regularly, and being a documentary filmmaker, it's often easy in the end to take a point of view. But I think this really said what any good editor says: just give me the facts.
Yeah. Keith Humphreys, to what extent are the precepts of, you know, what's behind these 12-step programs, are they really, you know, sort of good advice, philosophy for anybody?
Yeah, I sometimes joke that I'm the first non-alcoholic to recover in AA, because I've been studying it for 25 years, and I frankly think a lot of it is just very good wisdom about how to live. And one of the things that strikes you about the 12 steps is the word alcohol only appears in one of them. The other 11 are about things like admitting it when you're wrong, atoning for the bad things you do, not being selfish, being considerate of others. That's just good living.
Apologizing to people who you've done wrong to.
You bet.
Those kinds of things. And Peter, before I let you go, how does it work for you? Do you sponsor a number of people? Who is your and have you had the same sponsor for many years?
Well, I think I can only say for myself, my success is I haven't had a drink today, and that's as far as it goes. But I would like to just draw attention to one piece of the film which I have always found helpful, and that is it makes reference to they actually use the word the St. Francis prayer. And one of the lines in that prayer is that it's better to understand than be understood. And I think at the beginning, when you speak about two people who've had a problem with alcohol, speaking to each other and sharing their background and seeing how being understanding is the beginning of a change, I think that was really valuable for anybody sitting in the audience the night I saw the movie as something which registered and really spoke to me in a emotional and I also want to say in a intellectual way.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to thank you for making that movie.
All right. Well, thanks thanks so much, Peter, for joining us and sharing that with us. And let me ask you, Dan Carcino, the anonymity part of it, you know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. It's Bill W., even though we know Bill Wilson's identity now. And the people you interview in the film are who are members are in the shadows, although you can kind of make them out. It's not like you can't see them at all. Talk about that anonymity and what that's about and why it's important.
Okay, well, the anonymity, we know Bill Wilson's last name because he gave permission a couple of years before he died to have his anonymity broken posthumously. So
he wasn't – his last name was not known until he died.
No, if you read the obituary, I think, in the New York Times, which I think was on the front cover, it says that, you know, now we know
now
his
we can
last
reveal
name.
His name.
Yeah,
huh.
Yeah. But
and yet he was out. I mean, he was out speaking everywhere. He was hardly. He was not.
Yeah, but he was usually speaking within
the organization.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and he made a very conscious effort. We pointed out in the film, like he has the opportunity to be on the cover of Time magazine, and he turns it down. Not too many people would do that.
but did he do it because he didn't want the publicity, or what? That wasn't entirely clear to me. Clear to me was
well,
why he said
what,
no.
What he found is that anonymity has this twofold purpose. Okay, on from an organizational standpoint, they didn't want people early on identifying or becoming spokespeople for AA. Just as I'm not a spokesperson for AA, Keith isn't. Anybody in the film, everybody in the film would say before we began to interview him, "Hey, we want to make a point. We're not spokespeople for AA," and so. But the idea was that if you went out there with your full name and you were a famous person and you said, "I'm part of AA," and then you relapsed, that would reflect badly on the organization. So there was that practical aspect to it. There was the practical aspect of it that there's a stigma. You don't want people necessarily knowing that you're going to these meetings because that can affect your ability to earn a living. But there was this deeper purpose to it, which was an individual thing where it helped people maintain their humility and to really...
It's kind of a great equalizer too, in a way.
Well, it's an equalizer, but just from the standpoint of why are you in this fellowship, why are you helping others? And it's not for any self-aggrandizing purposes. It's to truly help others and to help yourself, but not to any personal gain.
Yeah. Keith Humphreys, would you add anything to that, the importance of anonymity?
Yeah, I'd just say that they were students of history. They knew about other movements and like themselves, for example, the Washingtonian movement in the 19th century. And what they saw from that is that three things have broken up a lot of recovery movements. One is getting involved in politics. Another is money. And then the third one is egos, personality, and celebrity. So they were consciously trying to get rid of those things in order to make their own organization thrive.
Yeah, and yet there are a lot of celebrities, no doubt, in AA.
There's been a change that's, you know, broader to the culture now that, you know, I know everything about Jennifer Aniston just because I shop at Safeway and every week I find out, you know, she's been dumped or she's pregnant and I don't even want to know, right? And that force is broader than AA that has happened, but it was certainly kept very well. There were many, many famous people in AA that were kept privately for decades.
That's Keith Humphreys, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford's School of Medicine. He's going to be with us for the rest of the hour, along with Dan Carasino. His new documentary that he co-produced and directed is Bill W. It premieres this week in the Bay Area. We'll have more details about that. And we want to hear from you, of course, 866-733-6786. We want to hear, in particular, I'd love to hear if you're in AA or perhaps one of the other spin-off movements, Gamblers Anonymous, and so on. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Michael Krasny. Much more to talk about. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this week for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we're talking about a new documentary. It's called Bill W., and it profiles Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our guests, Dan Carasino, who co-produced and directed the film along with Kevin Hanlon. And Keith Humphreys, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, who's done a lot of research into AA, with us as well. Again, the number to call if you want to share your story, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. I want to bring in another voice right now. Martin Nikolaus is founder of Life Ring, which is an alternative to AA, and he's also the author of three books on alternative recovery. Martin Nikolaus, good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
First of all, tell me, was there something about AA that didn't work for you?
Well, if I hold it together for the next 2 months or so, I'll have 20 years clean and sober. And all of that time, all of that recovery was done outside of AA. I myself have never been to an AA meeting.
And was there something about AA, some reason you didn't try AA?
Well, you know, I am in the majority of people, alcoholics who get clean and sober long term. There was a study by Dr. Vallance, who's a trustee of AA, who found that alcoholics who get clean and sober for 5 years or more, 60% of them do it without AA. There isn't any particular reason to dislike AA for you to decide to get clean and sober outside of AA. There are, of course, a lot of negatives to AA. I don't really like emphasizing them because what I really find most important about AA is that it's a group that provides social support for abstinence. And that's important. Social support for abstinence, no matter how you do it, is going to be helpful. And yeah. I respect AA tremendously for that.
Keith Humphreys,
but, are there other ways to get there besides AA?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Keith Humphreys, are there a certain... I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, kinds of people who are well suited to AA and other and those who, for some reason, just doesn't work for their personality or some other reason?
We've looked for that, we being scientists, for decades and never been able to come up with a profile of, you know, the AA type person. But what Martin is saying is absolutely true. People recover from alcoholism by all kinds of ways, including through Life Ring, through AA, through Women for Sobriety, through Smart Recovery, through treatment, through psychotherapy, and sometimes just because their life changes in some manner or another. So that's definitely true. It's not the only way. It's just a valuable way.
Yeah. And Martin, what is your approach? How does it differ from AA?
Well, our approach, for one thing, is a approach based on empowerment. We see the person who is in addiction as not only loving the drug and the alcohol and wanting to get deeper into it, but also profoundly hating the drug and hating the addiction and struggling very hard to get free of it. That tells us that the person is a divided person. Part of them is negative and part of them is positive, the part that wants to get free and sober. And what we call that the sober self. And what we try to do in our program is to empower that sober self, to make it stronger than the addicted self, so that the person can basically put the addicted self in jail inside of themselves and lead a normal drug and alcohol-free life with all the powers that creation has granted them.
Yeah.
So
we're an empowerment
approach rather than a powerlessness approach.
All right. Martin Nikolaus, thanks so much for joining us and describing that. Keith Humphreys, to what extent is just community, you know, having a place to go, having people to talk to, having a support network, basically, a key part of whether it's AA or any other kind of path towards sobriety?
It's as anyone who has been in a jogging group or a weight loss group could tell, you know, it helps a lot when you're trying to change your behavior to be with other people who share that goal and support you. And that's absolutely true of alcohol. And we see that over and over. Even people outside of AA, when you ask them, how did you change your alcohol, they often cite the support of other people as critical. It's not all of it, but it's part of – that's what they call the fellowship in AA. And then there's the program, which is the steps and the change and so on. And when you talk to AA members, it's very interesting. Some of them, you know, couldn't give a toss about the steps. They're not interested. They're there for the fellowship, and other people are really into the steps and working the steps. And that's like, you know, I think of it sort of like a church. You know, there's people who go to church because they want to hear the word of God, and there's people who go to church because they like the coffee and the cookies and talking afterwards.
Yeah. Let's read some email now. Matt writes, I saw the documentary last Thursday in Berkeley. I felt that the handling of Bill W.'s shortcomings warnings was fair and balanced. Also realized during the Q&A session that the director has a wealth of knowledge about Bill W. and Alcoholics Anonymous that he was not able to portray in the film. I encourage him to write a book. Dan, any thoughts of writing a book?
There actually are thoughts about writing a book. There was a lot of stuff that we couldn't include in the film.
Like what?
One of the things is, is I think the gentleman you just had calling in, Martin, Bill Wilson really embraced other ideas in terms of he never thought that AA was the only way. He was acutely aware that AA at best reached, I think the numbers were 1 in 100 people. I still think those are the numbers. It's funny. At the end of our film, we indicate that 2 million people are in AA. And I've had some people come up to me and say, wow, 2 million people. And then I've had other people come up to me and say, only 2 million.
Yeah. How many alcoholics are there?
Exactly. And it's a hard number to pin down. But So we have that. There's a big part of Bill Wilson's life that we couldn't get into at all because we didn't think we could contextualize it properly. And that was his interest in psychical research. His interest in, communing with the dead. Okay? Yeah. And so it's a very interesting thing.
Is that relevant to the AA part of him?
It's relevant to other aspects of his life. And it's relevant from the standpoint of the experience that he has. He is absolutely convinced of the existence of a higher power, of a God. And he is convinced of a continuation of life after death. And so you have this odd mixture with him where, on the one hand, he's this very spiritual person, and on the other hand, he's this very scientific person.
Yeah.
And this wonderful letter when he's 10 years old describing a chemical experiment to his mother, that's just – it blows me away every time I read it.
Yeah.
But in the 50s, there's a lot of optimism about pharmacology. There's optimism about science in general. And so, Duke University has a paranormal or a parapsychology department, it's taken very seriously that there's this energy that can be measured, and so we couldn't get into any of that.
Yeah, well, one thing he did get into is that toward the end of his life, he becomes very interested in LSD, which is being used in research facilities as a way of treating alcoholism, along with vitamin B3, niacin. What was it about those two things that that so enamored him?
Well, I think the LSD is a very layered thing for him, and there's a lot of correspondence on this. We found an enormous amount of material on it. And he starts taking it in August of 1956, and he has an experience. He writes about it similar to this experience that he had that changed his life. And so he begins to think that this has way – that this can access a plane for people that may be a way towards sobriety. So you have that aspect of it. It also has the aspect of the psychical research that he's doing. And so he becomes very enamored of the material, and he continues to take it for about, 5 or 6 years with the hope that it can do something. The niacin, he picks that up kind of after the LSD, and after there's this other material we couldn't get into. It's called leukoadrenochrome. Just the name tells you why we didn't get into it. But it has a similar calming effect on him, and they're unable to produce it, and so they go to niacin, and he sees this as a way towards emotional sobriety. He's seeing members of AA who have unhappy sobriety.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was going to say he doesn't seem like the happiest guy in the world, based on the film. I mean, he's a very austere kind of person in a way. He seems emotionally. A very narrow band of emotional range. Based on what you see in the film, anyway. And I'm not talking about the recreation, the dramatic recreations, but the video of him that you have, the film of him that you have.
Well, that film of him. He made that film. He made a film of himself in 1964 because he couldn't get around to the groups, and he tells his story. And to be honest with you, it's not one of his better tellings. It's a little wooden.
Yes.
And we limited how much of it we used because of that. I think he was a very warm man. What he was really known for was being absolutely single-minded in whatever he did. There's this great story where this AA member, Bill picks him up at what's now JFK at Idlewild in New York from the airport, and the car breaks down. But Bill is focused on discussing something to do with the traditions or something that he's writing. And this guy says that when the car breaks down, Bill pulls it over to the side of the road, and just continues the conversation. Says these cars are whizzing by. he's sort of terrified. And all Bill can talk about is this thing that he's talking about.
Single-minded.
And, yeah, very single-minded. Yeah.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number 866-733-6786. Linda is on the line in Petaluma. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. One of the traditions is around not promoting the programs, but I benefited from recovery for about 8 years before I met my husband in a program for love addicts. There's a program called Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and we've been in a program for recovering couples it's called Recovering Couples Anonymous, and there are phone meetings for all these programs now. So there, 2 million seems like a very small number to me, given our life in the programs. There are programs for under earners, debtors, anonymous, workaholics anonymous, and I put that out there because a lot of people need help, particularly around money issues now. Debtors Anonymous is a very comforting program, and there are lots of programs that are available by phone all day long, Al-Anon, for people who are related to alcoholics. And I just wanted to say, or have friends who are alcoholics, I just wanted to say that my own personal experience is the program is much greater than the sum of its parts, and that sitting in an AA meeting and really understanding what the old-timers and what even the newcomers have is much greater than the sum of the steps, and there is something spiritual that happens whether you want to be in a spiritual program or not, and I did not, having kind of misused all sorts of spirituality and Christianity in my own life. I had extreme repulsion to the word God, and I've recovered in a way that completely saved my life. One does not have to relate at all to their spiritual concepts to recover and to use the steps. And from my experience, using the whole program does help one recover in a way that's much greater than anything that can be described. And my own life just changed completely. And I would not be married. I had severe trauma on many levels, and it was impossible for me to relate in a way that was appropriate within a marriage. And we have a healthy marriage of almost 12 years. So,
all right. Well, good for you, and thank you for sharing that. Keith Humphreys, to what extent are the spouses of alcoholics and others who are in these AA kinds of programs helped?
Al-Anon had not been researched anywhere near as much as AA, which is an oversight. I'm actually happy to say that a colleague of mine at the Palo Alto VA, Chris Timko, just got a National Institute of Health grant to study Al-Anon, which I think is the first one. But to the extent we have information on Al-Anon, people who go tend to become less depressed, less resentful, and better at dealing with the intimate relationship that brought them there.
Yeah.
The other interesting finding is that at least we know this for husbands, if a husband is in AA and a wife is in Al-Anon, it is more likely that he will stay sober than if she is not.
And Dan Carosino, Lois Wilson, Bill Wilson's wife, boy, she sure put up with a lot. I mean, he was on the wagon, off the wagon, financially ruined. Describe their relationship a little bit. What was it like? Why was she so supportive? And what was, what was their dynamic?
Well, their dynamic, Lois sort of saves him when she first meets him from this despondent period that he's going through because of the death of a girlfriend who just suddenly dies. And he's in the trough of depression for, I think, 2 or 3 years. He's unable to graduate from high school for a bit. He's really crippled by it. And so the relationship immediately, she's 4 years older than he is. There's always this sort of – there's a mothering thing going on there. And then soon after they get married – I sometimes look at this from Lois's point of view, and I think, man, oh, man. She marries this – she meets him. He's coming off of this experience of depression, and she lifts him out of that. They get married. He begins drinking immediately. He actually begins drinking before they get married. And it goes down from there. And then, he fails to make it to her mother's funeral. He isn't there when she has a miscarriage, because he's drinking. He loses the family house essentially. He loses his job. She supports him. Then he founds AA, or co-founds AA. And for the next 20 years, he's committed to AA. 24
married to AA.
Married to AA, and it takes its toll on the marriage.
Yeah.
And so, But from the very beginning, she knows she is married to somebody special. She believes it. She does these things like we couldn't have told this story without Lois Wilson. She saved all of their letters. We read letters when they were, you know, courting. We have letters where when he was in his drunken states, he would write these nasty screeds to FDR. He wouldn't mail them. but he would write them, and they were pretty long. And then he would rip them up, and he'd apparently pass out, and she would come home, tape them together, and put them in a file.
Wow.
So you can actually read this stuff.
So she had a sense of history.
She had a sense of history. She had a real strong sense of history. She also does things like remove pages from her diaries, where I think there were some issues that they might have had that she didn't want to have public. She's controlling her image to some extent, Lois. But you know, they have a challenge. It's a challenging marriage, but a committed one.
Yeah, I mean, almost to the extent it makes you wonder. I mean, the things that you mentioned, she put up with, but she also finds out. You know, I think she had three miscarriages, and then
yes.
They wanted to adopt, and they never got permission to adopt, and they find out later it's because one of their friends says basically, "Hey, this guy's a drunk. You can't really place
friend.
Her
yeah.
closest friend." And yeah. what was the glue, or what did she need from him that she got? Do you think?
I think she just had an abiding love for Bill. That you know, the thing about Bill, even when he's drunk, he's just a really decent man. One of the things we heard these rumors about him that he was. You know, engage in financial skullduggery and things like this, right? But what we found is that when he was advising people and investing their money after the thing crashed, he wrote to these people and said, "I'll make it right." He wrote to an aunt and she said, "Look, I knew the risks, but there was never any sense of that he was out to take people's money." I think Lois just recognized his genuine decency. I mean, he's a really decent man.
Yeah. We've got some email here from listeners. Tony writes, "Can you ask your guest to explain in lay terms how AA actually works? Is it based on any theories or assumptions about people, about addiction? I'd like to hear more details about why it's effective." Keith Humphreys?
Sure. I mean, that's been studied quite a bit, and there's a number of different processes. You know, one is social support, contingent on abstinence. When I'm sober, I can hang around fun people who treat me well, and when I'm drunk, I can't. Second is people become better at coping. They're more active. When they have a problem, they don't sulk and brood. They learn how to seek information. What am I thinking? Be careful, that kind of thing. Lots of practical advice in AA. You know, if you can sit in an open meeting, by the way, and everyone should avail themselves of that who's interested, and I've done that. You know, the people say, you know, if you have somebody who you go out drinking with, don't hang out with them for now. You know, if you find yourself on a hot day thinking you really like a beer, call your sponsor or go to a meeting. Just, you know, real practical stuff like that. And last, helping seems to help people. And, you know, in other words, being a sponsor, caring for other people, taking on the role of guide and all that, that's one of the strongest predictors of staying sober.
And is there any sense of how many people fail, drop out of AA, go back to drinking?
Yeah, well, alcoholism, like most chronic disorders, is you know, many, many people are going to have a bad result, as you see in cancer, as you see in heart disease and so on. It seems to me, you know, what I've observed when I look over the research is about a third of people, when they first go, take to it like ducks to water. And a year later, they're still in AA and they are doing much, much better. There's another third of people who hate it and never go back and say they're worthless, or even I was damaged by that. That was so rotten. I mean, I'll never go back to AA. And then there's an interim group that will often go for a bit and then kind of drift in and out and derive some benefit. And they may be people, they're not there a year later, but they're there 5 years later.
Is there an element of, you know, gee, I'm kind of a lousy person and I can't control my life and I'm a, you know, does it feed into a lack of self-esteem in some way?
Well, not really, because you're around other people who are saying the same thing. So, you know, it'd be depressing to come in and say, gosh, we're all lousy and everything's terrible and you're lousy and welcome to the lousy club. But of course, that's not what happens. You come and you see, wow, this guy was just like me. And look at him now. He looks great. He looks healthy. He looks happy. He's got a good marriage. He's got a good job. And AA even says that in the AA book, the big book, they call it. They say, you know, we tell these stories in the hopes that something will catch in you. and you'll get some hope and a vision for the future. So for most people, AA tends to be an uplifting experience rather than one that grinds down their sense of hope.
Here's an email from Sean, who, picking up on this theme, is there any actual evidence that shows AA works? There is none. AA does not divulge its numbers at all. It's like a cult organization and has harmed more lives than helped. It has enslaved people, my brother, and has convinced people that if they do not attend meetings, they will die. It is a religious-based Christian God-worshipping cult.
Wow. A lot of quite an indictment. The fastest-growing 12-step fellowship in the world is in Iran. So I guess they don't know it's a Christian fellowship. I mean, AA has conquered the world because of the fact that its spirituality is so flexible. And in terms of does it work? Well, in medicine, the best studies we do are called randomized clinical trials. When we randomize people to get an introduction to AA, they're far more likely to be clean and sober later. So that's good evidence.
Yeah. Anything you'd add to that, Dan?
One thing I would say about AA that, and again, I'm not a spokesperson for it, but there seems to be a genuine misunderstanding about the whole notion of powerlessness. People tend to stop reading at that word. And AA, from the people we met and just seeing how their lives have changed, you know, the step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. They're not saying they're powerless over anything else in their life. And there's this paradoxical thing that seems to happen where by admitting that they're powerless over it, over alcohol or whatever, it's sort of like fill in the blank. It's gambling, you know, love relationships, whatever that thing is, that enables them to take control and responsibility over other aspects of their life.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. Byron is calling from Milpitas. Hey, Byron.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on.
I was just calling about the issue of people being forced into recovery programs without a choice, not being allowed to choose. Both the legal system and private systems force individuals into support programs without a choice.
Keith Humphreys, let me just ask you, how are they being forced?
The legal system, the court systems, insurance systems, HMO systems.
Yeah,
right.
Keith.
No, there are judges who will sentence, like, say, for example, someone arrested for drink driving to go to AA meetings. And my own view, the best setup we could have is have a whole range of options available, which we actually do have in the Bay Area in terms of various fellowships and various treatment options. And you know, there'd be many pathways to recovery rather than forcing everyone to do one thing.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Byron, for the call. Here's another legal-related question from a listener, Tracy, I think it is, who writes, in my job, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I deal often with alcoholics and other addicts, so I'm obviously always interested in knowing about recovery. At the top of the show, it was mentioned that there are two types of alcoholics, yet only one was discussed. Can you please explain what the second type was? Dan, I don't remember, or maybe it was...
What we were told is that there is a... I think it roughly falls into this about... One in four alcoholics, when they first pick up a drink, maybe one in five, I think clinically they would call it a positive reaction, that they're immediately alcoholic. Bill Wilson was of that type. The other type, it developed, it's late onset, okay? Somebody has a triggering event in their life where before they could pick up a glass of wine, they wouldn't have a reaction to it. Now suddenly they're reacting very differently to it. And that is actually the majority of people who suffer from alcoholism.
And are there any implications for being one or the other?
I think it ultimately devolves into the same disease. I mean, they both have the same sort of trajectory that if you don't, it's what is it? It's primary, fatal. I forget the terms they use.
Well, about half. On average, it's going to take about 10 years off your life. So it's very serious as illness goes, and one of the biggest burdens for disease, not just in our country, around the world. Hmm. So whether you are one of those people who the first time you have a drink, it feels like, you know, the key in the lock that has always been missing, or the kind of person that it creeps up on over time, you're still at tremendous risk.
Well, and where's the line between being a drinker, a heavy drinker, or being an alcoholic?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, no, that really is a good question. And at Port America, AA's line has to do with identity and their particular way of seeing it. It's not the same as how you would be diagnosed, for example, in a medical treatment center where we list a bunch of symptoms and say, do you need to drink more and more and more to get the same effect? You find yourself obsessing about it. You have sweats. You have shakes, all that sort of stuff. And AA tied it more to character. You don't have alcoholism in AA. You are an alcoholic. It's something essential to identity, which is a bit different than how it's thought about in medicine.
Yeah. And Dan, this movement, of course, was built around him and Dr. Bob, but it's grown tremendously since he died. What is it that keeps it together? Is there a hierarchy of any kind, or is it just sort of group by group by group?
That to me is the genius of Bill Wilson. What he was encouraged to have a very strict hierarchy in the 40s by a priest. Who would know something
who
about hierarchy.
Yeah.
And Bill Wilson said, we don't need that. He said that we have the ultimate enforcer. He would call it John Barleycorn, but he obviously meant alcohol. And he said, so what he does is he has a sort of loose, it's a loose confederation of groups. Each group is autonomous in its dealings, except when it affects AA as a whole. And that's kind of the way he structured it. And then organizationally, it's an inverted pyramid. The general manager of AA is at the bottom of the pyramid, and the membership is at the top. They have control of it and responsibility for it. It makes it very difficult to get anything done.
And how do they keep? How do they have money? Where do they get money from?
Well, they actually have a notion of corporate poverty. They just.
Do they get that from the priest also?
they actually got that from a different priest. but the idea of it. They get their money mostly from the publication of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and they try to maintain 1 year's prudent reserve of money. And yeah. I think the groups do the same thing.
Yeah. All right. Again, the film is called Bill W. It opens Friday, August 3rd at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco and the Elmwood Rialto Cinemas in Berkeley, and we'll be playing there for a while, I believe. Dan Carasino, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks also to you, Keith Humphreys.
Thank you.
And to our guests earlier in the hour as well. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, and Vinnie Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.